all ready to go here? Looks like it is. Okay. All right. Good morning, everyone. Convene the February 4th, 2014 session of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Good morning to all of you. We're going to be hearing four bills today. Before we do that, we're going to need to adopt our committee rules so that we can actually conduct a business. Everyone had a chance to take a look at the rules, which I don't think have changed appreciably or maybe at all.
In 10 years.
Any questions or discussions? I will recognize Vice Chair Frederick.
Am I supposed to read something? Ah, yes. Chair Witt, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 4th, 2014.
Representative Frederick moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 4th, 2014. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none and hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative
Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Thompson. Yes. Representative Unger. Yeah, two or three. Excused. Representative Witsek.
Aye.
Co-chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Co-chair Friedrich.
Aye.
Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Chair Witt. Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes, and we have rules adopted for our committee. Thank you, committee members. Now for our first order of business, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Concurrent Resolution Number 203, and would like to recognize Representative Huffman. And I don't know if you have others.
Mr. Chair, I, like you, never quite know if I should wait on Senator Farioli or not, and I usually don't. So,
well, if you waited on the Senate, you'd be waiting till things got really frozen.
Do I hear a big amen? For the record, John Huffman, state rep for House District 59, which includes most of Wasco County. And so I hold some suspense back for the House floor. If it's okay, Mr. Chair, I'll dispense with the whereases and just plead with the committee to support this extremely controversial bill that celebrates Wasco County's 100th anniversary at Hunt Park in Tie Valley.
Good.
Summation of the bill.
Is,
with the exception of all the whereases. And
this is a wonderful bill. We're pleased to have you bring it forward, and we're very, very pleased that the folks at Wasco County will be recognized for many years of their fair, and also I believe there's a rodeo there.
There is
as well. Excellent.
Car crash 'em up derby and all kinds of fun stuff. Hard work and fair board, like so many counties mm-hmm. around the state. They do a great job of keeping it going, and I do appreciate them. So I'm not trying to slight them at all, but want to save some suspense for the House floor. But I'm more than happy to answer questions.
Absolutely, and I think Vice Chair Frederick may have a question or comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Huffman, I was just wondering whether you were planning on gracing us with showing us your skill at horseback riding at bronco busting at the fair. Are you planning on doing that?
Chair Witt, co or co vice chair? Did you get elevated?
It's a field promotion.
That would be a no. No.
And why not?
I fell off my bicycle on the way, so I'm not about to get on a horse.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to save a little of my fireworks for the House floor as well, but just today, just for fun. My understanding is back in early 2014, there was a festival that was elsewhere.
But nearby.
Yeah, but I'm not sure it's fair to I mean, sometimes festivals turn into fairs depending on what type of costumes are adorned that day. So are you sure it's fair to say this is the home of the fair since 1914, given the festival nearby in a different park?
Chair Witt, Representative Clem, I'm fairly certain.
Oh, God. I'm not gonna try that again on the floor if he's going to use puns. That is not... That's the lowest form of humanism, Chair. It's in the rules. No puns. It's in the rules. I saw it.
Representative Krieger.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I understand the event that he took part in at the fair was outlawed last year, the horse tripping.
Oh.
My question.
Do we have... Are there pictures? That's the question. Oh,
boy. Are there pictures? Sorry, I started.
Mr. Chair, please control yourself.
We understand, too, that you may be in competition with the fair and rodeo in Omak, Washington, where they ride their horses over the cliff and down the embankment into the river.
Really?
Do we have movies of you participating in that event as well?
No, but I did enjoy the movie. Man from Snowy River.
Any further questions or comments for Representative Huffman? Seeing none, hearing none. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks so much.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify at this point on House Concurrent Resolution number 203? Not seeing anyone. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 203. And I am going to temporarily reopen the voting for adoption of our committee rules to receive votes from committee members who were not present when we took the vote.
Thank you, Chair.
Absolutely. I'm not exactly sure. I know Rep. Unger was not here. I don't know if there was anyone else who wasn't present for the vote. But would you please call the roll for the remaining members?
Representative Unger.
Aye.
And with that, thank you very much, Representative. Appreciate that. We're going to close that. And the rules were Representative Unger adopted. So.
I saw that.
Okay.
So it was funny. Out of my office.
And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4045. Beth, could you tell us briefly what that bill entails?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4045 would retroactively revive the Well Constructors Continuing Education Committee and the statutory provisions related to the Continuing Education Program for licensed water well constructors. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you very much. Let's see here. Who do we have signed up for? Hold on just a second. Thank you. All right, we have signed up, please, Phil Ward. And Phil, I think you may have some other folks to bring up as well. Good morning to both of you.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee.
Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department, and Mr. Chair, I wanted to bring with me this morning our new legislative coordinator, Raquel Rancier. Many of you know Brenda Bateman, who worked for us in that role for a number of years. She's now moved to another position in the agency. So, Raquel, I wanted to personally introduce Raquel to you, as she will be our general face working with you on a daily basis in the Capitol. So,
good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, with that, I'd like to ask Raquel to introduce this bill to you all.
All right.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, this is actually my first time testifying on a bill. I used to be on the other side as a committee administrator. So thank you for the opportunity to present testimony on Senate Bill 1512, a bill that would reinstate the Well Construction Continuing Education Program and the requirement that well constructors complete continuing education credits for license renewal. There are approximately 300,000 wells in Oregon, many of which supply water for drinking. Improper well construction or abandonment can lead to groundwater contamination and waste. Therefore, persons who construct, alter, convert, or abandon a well are required to obtain a well constructor's license to ensure that they have the proper equipment, knowledge, and skills. In 2001, the Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 579, which established the Well Constructor Continuing Education Program and required well constructors to complete continuing education credits in order to renew their licenses as of June of 2005. Continuing education courses are approved by the Well Constructor Continuing Education Committee, which is composed of well drillers and a member of the regulatory community, which is the Water Resources Department. In order to satisfy the continuing education requirement to renew a license, the well constructor is required to provide proof of completion of 14 continuing education credits for every two-year period. Continuing education credits must include courses pertaining to groundwater and well construction laws, and credits may be obtained through clinics, schools, professional organizations, seminars, or lectures. A broad array of approved courses are also offered online. Many of them are free of charge or under $40. Examples of groups that offer these courses include the Oregon Groundwater Association, who actually worked with us to bring forward this bill, and I think you'll be hearing from them later, as well as the International School of Well Drilling and the National Drilling Association, among others. In 2007, Senate Bill 88 extended the sunset on the program to January 2, 2014. So the committee program and requirements have sunset, and this bill would essentially reinstate and revive that program. The department believes that requiring well constructors to complete continuing education courses helps well constructors maintain and advance their skills. This in turn helps the groundwater resource in terms of protecting it, as well as protecting the well owners. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you very, very much. Sounds like a great idea and something that we should be engaged in. Questions or comments? Vice Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm in a profession that has continuing ed as well, and it seems 75 to 85% of the information that we receive for continuing ed is stuff that we've had in the past. I would like to see us embark upon some continuing ed that either brings you up to date on different changes, but doesn't require, like mine requires 30 hours, I think it is, something of that nature, and probably 25 hours or repeat. So I don't know if it's the same in this particular instance or not, but I was wondering if we could figure out how to separate the wheat from the chaff and update people on stuff that needs to be updated, and don't worry about the stuff that they've already learned, just to fill in a slot for continuing it.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, if I might, we've had a great relationship over time with the Oregon Groundwaters Association, essentially the Well Drillers Association here in Oregon, and I think you'll hear from Jerry Schmidt in just a moment on that, but they, in combination with us, have worked really hard to bring timely new topics forward, and that's one of the things I've appreciated about the program is the number of kind of new things that come forward. I'm sure there's always some of that overlap that we could work to because you're always dealing with a variety of people in the organizations in terms of the training piece, in terms of their experience. But I think Jerry will be able to articulate perhaps better than I, but we've had a strong relationship with them in terms of building this coursework so that it's actually useful to the well drilling community.
Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. I was wondering, since I'm really not that familiar, do you have a geologist or hydrologist on site, or go through your well logs after a well is drilled, and do you keep the samples or the logs, depending on what you do now?
Mr. Chair, Representative, certainly we have what we call hydrogeologists on staff, and we our goal is to inspect at least 25% to to hands-on field inspect at least 25% of all new wells constructed in the state of Oregon. We usually exceed that. And then, yes, indeed, we do have well logs on every well that's drilled, and we do keep those as a part of our database and use them all the time in our groundwater work around the state.
Do you know, how long you've been doing that? You know, I know some older wells don't have any information on them. You know, they were prior to sort of the modern era. And do you know when you started requiring that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not certain the exact date, but I know that we have well logs that are 50 years old plus
at least
in the state. So we've got a lot of long-time well logs.
Okay.
Mr.
Great.
Chair, Representative.
Very good. Additional questions or comments? This may or may not be too technical. I don't mean to put you on the spot if it is, but when I was reading up on the bill, I read someplace, it may have even been your own background material, I don't recall, but it said that there's a potential exists for inappropriately drilled wells to possibly contaminate the groundwater, and I was just interested in what the contamination might be and how that might happen.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. There are, as you can imagine, there are a number of potential well construction issues that can arise when a well's not constructed properly. Probably one of the most common is lack of a good seal. And so if you don't have a good seal around a constructed well, then surface water contamination from many different sources can run down that well and pollute the aquifer. And so we have, you know, just from my view, we have a strong community of well drillers in Oregon that do a really credible job in terms of well construction, and part of that is a result of this program working together with the industry to put some training in place to keep that from happening.
Okay, very good. Anything else? Not seeing anything. Thank you both very much. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on... Oh, excuse me, we do have someone else. We have Jerry Schmidt. And is there anyone else out there who is intending to testify on this bill today? Okay. Jerry, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the men and women of the Oregon Groundwater Association. Including in that membership is the drilling community. We have other members which are consulting hydrogeologists, engineers, consultants, pump installers, water treatment, virtually anybody dealing with groundwater. One aspect of it is the drilling community, and they have the association has been active in continuing ed training prior to this bill. They will continue to be active no matter what happens. Anyway, we will continue to offer continuing ed. This bill did come about in 2001. We didn't oppose the bill at that time. We still don't. We endorse education. That's the primary importance of trying to keep our community up on what's going on. I like some of the points that brought out Representative Esquivel included about making things pertinent, and that's our goal, is trying to keep things pertinent. I know that there are other organizations that have limits on continuing ed. We thought about it. I think at this point we're still willing to work with the department. They've had some changes there within staff that kind of opens up some of our issues that we can talk with them and see if we can change some of these things by rule. If not, and there's some issues, we may be back in the future. But at this point, we have no problems with the bill, and we thank you for the opportunity to testify. Well, and I'm here to answer any questions that you may
have. Thank you for your comments. I appreciate that. Anything further for Mr. Schmidt? Any members?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Last and final call for the public testimony on House Bill 4045. Anyone? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4045, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4046. Beth, if you could just briefly remind us what that one's about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4046 would appropriate money from the general fund to the Department of Fish and Wildlife to study the effects of cormorant predation on juvenile salmon. There is no revenue impact, and we don't have a fiscal impact statement. As you'll note in the bill, that there is a blank right now for the dollar figure.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We have several people signed up. I'm going to call forward, please, Jim Myron, Tom Wolfe, and Joe Rolater. And Bill Cluding, we have you on deck.
The cleanup hitter.
Good morning, Chair Witt.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. My name is Jim Myron. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. And I put down on the testimony sheet that Native Fish Society is neutral. We are neutral on the original bill. I believe in your packet there's a dash one amendment that Mr. Rolater and I have worked on with the chair in recent weeks. And with the addition of that dash one amendment, we would be supportive of the bill, and we would help to try and find some money in the Ways and Means Committee. You're out of money. with that, let me just talk specifically about the Dash One Amendment would do.
Please.
And I've passed around a section of a recent report from the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team, which is the state's peer review body for state agencies. And they recently commented on the draft of ODFW's Coastal Salmon Plan. And in there is a small section on predation. And what you have there that was distributed is page 4 of the report, down at the bottom, talks about predation and the need to they do say predation needs further study, and they give some recommendations in that short little paragraph about what sort of things should be included in that study. So what the Dash One Amendment does is just simply direct ODFW to consider the recommendations in that IMST report as they put together a study plan.
Very good. Very good. And we're actually going to be having copies of this passed around to the committee members. So very good. Thank you.
So I'll leave it there and be happy to answer questions when we get to that.
Okay, great. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolfe, Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm here to state that Trout Unlimited supports House Bill 4046 and especially the Dash 1 amendments. We have a great concern as a group of fishermen who are also conservationists about the impact of cormorants and other bird species are having on salmon runs in our state and in our waters, and we believe that further studies need to be done to ascertain the impacts they're had, the further impacts to see specifically how they're targeting the fish species are going after. So we support this, and as Jim stated, we'll help you in any way we can to help get funding for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rolater. I'm here today representing the ALSEA Sportsman's Association. Mm-hmm. We've been very active in the whole cormorant management issue for about 5 years. We noticed that cormorants were congregating on the out-migrating smolts when they got down to the head of tide. They had to make changes in their metabolism from bringing water in through their gills to bringing water in through the skin. And so we started this process, and we found out that 20-plus other states already have a depredation order, and it was issued to protect aquaculture, catfish farms. So these other states have lethal authority, or authority for lethal management to protect catfish. And then we also found some scientific studies that were part of a separate environmental assessment station. There's one in New York that we've talked to you about before. And then today I've given you question and answers about the one in Minnesota. And in the Minnesota case, which was done in 2004, issued in 2005, it seems like they didn't have to do as many things as Fish and Wildlife Service has asked the state of Oregon to do, but it's along the same lines. You had to prove, you had to show that there was a problem, you had to show that there was a reasonable scientific evidence that the problem was the predator birds, and then you have to say what you're going to do and go through a public process. And of course, this is very expensive. So with 4046, it gives us, fishermen, the department, and you all a tool to use if we need some more assets to complete all the information that Fish and Wildlife Service wants from us. I also gave you a little handout on the public comment period on the environmental assessment on the Columbia of Caspian terns. But it also includes double-crested cormorants, and there's fairly good evidence that those birds in combination are eating anywhere from 5 to 20% of the out-migrating salmon each year, and there's probably 100 million out-migrating salmon in the Columbia, so do the math. A hatchery-produced smolt, so the 20% is both hatchery and wild fish. A hatchery-produced smolt costs on the order of $1 to get to the ocean. And so we're losing essentially $20 million of state and federal resources. And also, when those fish come back, our fishermen try to catch them, and we catch them, and then we either use them for guiding or we use them for selling under the commercial fisheries. So I think it's very important that we pursue this cormorant issue. I've seen the birds build up on my river from almost no cormorants in the spring to maybe 300 to 500 now in the spring. I've watched how they fish. Cormorants actually fish. They get together in a school of about 40 birds and they push the salmon smolts up onto the shallow water where they can eat them. And it's very interesting to watch, but it's also kind of one of those things where, oh my gosh, those are my fish that I've done all this habitat work for, and I've cleaned out the trap at the hatchery and all those other things that us volunteers have done. So I hope you pass this bill on to Ways and Means, and that we use it if we need it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Joe, I don't want to put you on the spot either with this question, but I'm curious. You mentioned something on the order of 5 to 20% predation on the out-migrating juvenile salmonids. I think that was terns and cormorants.
That's correct.
How does that compare with any other causes of death of the juveniles on their out-migration? Would that be a top cause? Would that be, are there several others that are bigger than that cause death to these juveniles?
Chair Witt, I'm not a biological scientist, I can't really answer that question, but my empirical knowledge tells me that it's probably pretty high. there's a small percent of the fish actually do return, and so there's a lot of mortality along the way.
Yes.
We did a pit stag study on the Al Sea, and there was no mortality until the out-migrating steelhead got, and this was both hatchery and wild steelhead, got down to the head of tide, and it's kind of circumstantial, but there are all these cormorants there, and we lost 1 year a third and 1 year two-thirds of the out-migrating salmon in a two-day period of time.
How much was that again?
We lost from one-third to two-thirds of the out-migrating steelhead, both wild and hatchery, that we put little pit tags in,
yes,
so we know they just went dead. We lost a large percentage, that third or two-thirds, in a very short period of time over a course of 3 years.
And the you have made a connection with predation in terms of that loss?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. We hope that the department, and we see from what I handed out an outline of some of the information that ODF&W has recently put out about their program, and we are definitely finding a cause and effect. We just haven't gotten all the numbers worked out yet. So we know they're probably out-migrating salmon are probably being predated by birds, and they're probably being predated at a significant rate.
I would say that is very significant, if in fact it's predation. Additional questions or comments, Representative Reardon?
Just two questions. I have no expertise in this area at all, so please forgive my ignorance. But one question is, what other information do you have going along the lines, do we actually need another study? I don't know.
I think, Representative Reardon, I'm going to invite the department up here probably in the next two panels, and that would be an appropriate question for them, which I think they have some late-breaking news on. So,
would they also address the design of the study, or where does that come up?
Well, I think the answer to the former may take care of the latter, so... If you wouldn't mind just holding those questions.
Okay, yeah.
Very good. Additionally, Representative Krieger, Mr. Cormorant.
Can't imagine, huh?
Mr. Cormorant.
Jim, you had given me the information about the multidisciplinary team. I'll make a comment about that later. But is the Wild Fish Society concerned about the number of wild fish, naturally born fish, that predation might be taking when you put it in the light of the large increase of cormorants that we've seen over the last 20 years? We do know that the numbers have exploded. Range hasn't changed a whole lot, but it definitely has exploded. Is your group concerned about their predation on the wild fish?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, the Native Fish Society is concerned about the status of wild fish in Oregon, certainly, and to the extent that any particular issue is having a detrimental effect on restoration and enhancement of those populations, we would be concerned about it. Where predation fits in the scheme of things is kind of still an open question, and I think in the IMST report they talk about the fact that there's not a lot of data to indicate where predation does fit, but in certain places and with certain species, predation is a major problem. In the Columbia, for example, if 20% of the population is being lost to predation, that's maybe more than what the dams used to kill. So it is a major issue.
Please.
Just a comment. You know, we discussed last year, and Mr. Rohleder brought forward the Nehalem study that was done in 1999 to 2001 that was published in 2002 by U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Oregon State. Basically, when you get it all done and look at it, That study says we're losing 50% of our smolts to cormorants alone, not counting mergansers or seals, which also prey heavily. And when we talked about this last year in the other bill we had, we discussed the fact, in fact, you gave me the number, $57 million is being spent by the federal and state in the hatchery system that benefits Oregon. If you were to project that, which I know you can't exactly because it varies from stream to stream a little bit, but even saying that it's $1 million a month over a biennium, $24 million, that's still less than half of the 57. That's $1 million a month or $250,000 a week of fish were being eaten by a predator. Now, nobody in their right mind in the pre-enterprise system would allow that to happen, yet we've done basically nothing. So I think we need to understand that. I think it is a much more larger problem than we really understood earlier. Predation, I think, even with, as you saw with elk and cougar, wolves and elk, and when we had the issue of coyotes with antelope taking 75% within 24 hours, those things are not acceptable, not only naturally occurring, but in a free enterprise system, if it was a private cattle or ranch, that type of situation. I've had some rather bad relationships with a multidisciplinary science team when I was on the Board of Forestry. I don't know if our chair recalls what happened there. But if I look at the paragraph that they wrote, I'm somewhat disappointed, and there's something I read the other day that I think would apply here. They need to read and educate themselves and work their way up to ignorant.
How do you really feel, Representative?
Mr. Chair, I wish you'd put candy coat and things.
Well, are there further questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you for your appearance. I want to particularly thank you for bringing the Dash 1 amendment forward. While I share sometimes Representative Krieger's frustrations with some of the reports that are brought forward, I nonetheless want to at every turn encourage folks who appear before us to base as much of their testimony as possible on scientifically based information. Representative Frederick and I took a tour of Eastern Oregon prior to the Christmas holidays, and one of the things that I came away from that tour realizing is that not everybody has a scientific understanding of the problems that we face, but everyone has an opinion, and I vastly prefer the scientific information over opinions. And with that, I want to encourage you bringing that forward. I want to encourage everyone who testifies before our committee to do likewise. I think that is what helps us, and particularly folks like myself who are not scientists, to be able to make a judgment call based on sound information and consequently helps us make better public policy. So I thank you for that, and I thank you for your involvement. With that,
thank you, sir.
Good day to each of you. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Bill Cluding.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Committee, for the record, Bill Cluding, a concerned fisherman. I first showed this in this committee 2005. Save Our Smolts, SOS. At that time, we only had 5,000 nesting pairs. I'll just stick right with the Sand Island in the main stem of the river here in the northwest. Although it is a statewide problem, these birds nest on the island that just a few years back was not there. I blame the Army Corps engineers. I blame us for allowing those islands to be formed. I print another sheet out at 10,000 nesting pairs. This is 15,000 nesting pairs, and this is 2 years old. And this is on Sand Island, one island. The critical part of this island is it's right where the smolts coming down of all the streams in the northwest that feed into the Columbia River. It's right where they stop and spend 3 weeks just circling, getting used to salt water. If they don't stop there and go on out, they die. They have to adjust their bodies, their liver, for the salt water. This is where they get picked off. I've learned a lot about this bird. I can tell you that we don't know how many birds is out there because they only count the nesting pairs. A year-old bird or a two-year-old bird does not nest, but they're still eating smolts. No way to count them. Three years ago, Bonneville stated that so far $13 billion has been spent on salmon recovery in the Northwest. $13 billion. The bill so far last fall, according to Bonneville, NOAA, and Northwest Power Conservation was $800 million last year alone on salmon recovery. Who pays for this? The ratepayers in the Northwest. You, me, every state that uses Bonneville Power pays this bill. There's three major flyways in this country: the east, middle, and the west. U.S. Fish and Wildlife has been generous enough to allow the East Coast people to control this bird. They've allowed the Midwest people to control this bird. The way they do it, they're allowed to shoot these birds 7 months out of the year. When we asked for help from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, they denied us. I don't understand why. I mean, we're dealing with threatened fish, endangered fish. We need help on this. And this bill is a start. I appreciate the chair's willing to bring in some experts to really, really fill you in on this. I can guarantee you that these birds cannot tell a wild fish from a hatchery fish. They don't care. So the big fight between wild and hatchery, we can solve part of that problem by controlling these birds. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? Representative Whitsett?
Thank you for your testimony. I would just like to say, and I mentioned it last year, but in the Klamath Basin, we see entire stretches of ancient trees that have lined our rivers, the Lost River in particular, and around the lake, that have been destroyed by hundreds and thousands of cormorants that sit in them and defecate, basically, and destroy the trees. So we, 40 years ago, when I came to the Klamath Basin, we had a lot of really nice, tall trees along some of the stretches of the river, and within, I would say, the last 10 years, they are completely dead, and they're just lining the banks, and the cormorants have just multiplied unbelievably. And I know that they showed an increase that the Klamath Basin has one of the largest populations of cormorants on the West Coast. And so it isn't just, I know we're addressing salmon here, but you know, all of our fish are being destroyed by these birds and their multiplication, basically. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Anything further? Bill, thank you very, very much. appreciate your testimony and continuing to update us on the population figures. Next, I'd like to call up the department, please. And before they begin their testimony, one thing that I'd like for the two of you to do is, I think the testimony to this point has been kind of insider's testimony. I'm not sure anyone who's watching on the television actually knows what this bill may do. So if you could just give us a very brief description. And then the committee members, I am going to I'm going to mention a few things here, and I think that the department is has always been and continues to try to be very deferential to the wishes of this committee and the fact that we have put a bill forward. I'm not speaking for the department, but I think that sometimes they are in an awkward position. Perhaps yes, perhaps not. But are somewhat reluctant maybe to discuss differences of opinion in terms of the current need for this bill. And what I am suggesting to you is we move this bill forward, and I was one of the chief proponents of moving it forward. I think since the 2013 session, there may have been, and that will be one of my questions to our two panelists, there may have been some positive movement with folks at the federal level who may have, who may be more inclined to want to assist us in managing the cormorant population. And that is why I have asked the department to come forward. I think it would be helpful if we asked them questions. And with that, gentlemen, I would like to kick this off by first having you give a brief summary of the bill and then answer the question, if you would, have things changed in terms of the federal government's willingness, perhaps, to assist us in our quest to be able to manage cormorant populations? Thank you for your appearance.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. We did not bring formal comments on the bill per se, but I did want to mention that when Chair Witt originally talked to us about this concept and he asked, were there additional things that we could be doing on as it related to cormorant work, we certainly think there are a couple projects, and we've talked to the chair about those projects. We consider them largely enhancements to our ongoing work, not necessarily central or essential to our application, but certainly they're enhancements. And I'll let Ron Anglin here talk a little bit about the process, but we are here in the next several months, we will be resubmitting our application for basically a depredation permit to kill cormorants, quite simply. So we did provide some projects and some basic, very brief work plans that describe what we'd do under those projects, which we consider to be enhancements. On the subject that was discussed earlier, a number of Senator Krieger talked about it and others, with regard to the IMST's comments, Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team's comments, and I don't have the language right here in front of me, but I have read their report, and what they're really referring to is this question about compensatory mortality versus additive. You know, so the fundamental question is, well, you guys have shown that there's cormorants, say, that are eating smolts, but you haven't shown whether those smolts were going to die anyway, and there's compensation in these populations. And quite frankly, that's an entirely different animal. To answer that question would be a heavy lift, whether you could in the end or not. So I just wanted to make sure that as we talk about this bill, if the expectation is we're going to answer the IMST's question, it's probably a much different budget than that we shared with you, Chair Witt. So we are moving forward with our application. We have, and as was alluded to, had much better meetings with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on this topic. I do want to let Ron address that a little bit, Ron Anglin here, and then we're also happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very, very much.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. We have, in fact, as we reported to you last spring, met with Fish and Wildlife Service and feel like we have made progress with them. They've outlined the types of things that they feel we need to gather from an information standpoint, and that actually resulted in you working with Ways and Means and getting us some additional funds last session, general funds that we matched with some of the federal dollars that we had coming in, and we're enhancing some of the work that we've been doing on the ground relative to cormorants to answer those questions. So we are on track with raising efforts that we've been undertaking. We are implementing, per their request, flyway-wide, a new monitoring, population monitoring and assessment of cormorants that all of the states in the Pacific Flyway have bought into. This will be the first year of those surveys. They will be repeated every 3 years, I believe it is 3 or 4 years, by all the states. And once we work our way through that, we will have some pretty accurate estimates of the breeding population of cormorants within the Pacific Flyway. Kurt's right, we are in the process of finalizing our depredation permit request for this spring for the Tillamook in particular, based on the diet studies that we've been conducting as part of our scientific take permit with Fish and Wildlife Service, and we're hopeful that we will get that permit from them. You never know, but we're hopeful that we will get that permit from them this spring and allow us to move out of the scientific part of it to be able to do some specific depredation work in some of the estuaries. The service has also committed that they are going to start working towards, I believe it's 2015-2016, developing an environmental assessment within the Pacific Flyway that would move us forward in a flyway-wide ability to control cormorants and not a state-by-state basis. So there's lots of different things that are playing out at this point in time.
And overly simplified, we may be in a better place now than we were during the 2013 session with respect to the wishes of some of the committee members here to be able to convince the feds that we need to regulate cormorant populations?
Chair Witt, I believe that is the case. You've had Richard Cannon come and talk to the committee in the past. We met with him and his staff last spring, and he made commitments for moving forward. You know, we have a saying within our own department about don't keep asking us to bring another rock. Just tell us what we need to put in the wheelbarrow and let us wheel the barrow one time. And he agrees with that. So we feel like we're on the right track with the service, and we're hopeful that we've got movement occurring relative to the coastal stuff. The Columbia is tied up with what's going on with the Corps of Engineers, and they will be releasing hopefully their draft environmental assessment sometime this spring for public review on the actions that they're planning on taking relative to the Columbia, both the mid-Columbia and the lower Columbia, and we're part of that process in commenting and helping, trying to help develop that environmental assessment. And really stressing that we don't want to see, as a result of any actions taken in the Columbia, displacement of birds into the coastal estuaries of Oregon.
Thank you very, very much. Representative Reardon, I know you had a couple of questions. I don't know if this has helped or if you have additional.
This is helpful. Are cormorants still protected?
Gentlemen. Chair Witt, Representative Reardon, yes. Cormorants are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And the depredation orders that are referred to back in the Midwest were as a result of the service going through an environmental assessment and complying with the Migratory Bird Treaty Act to allow take. And so far, we haven't had that happen out here on the West Coast, and we've been pushing to have that happen. We actually petitioned last spring. They were reauthorizing the Midwest depredation order, and Oregon and Washington petitioned to be included in that, and the Fish and Wildlife Service declined to include us at the national level. So we're pushing now for the Pacific Flyway level to have actions taken.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How are they, what kind of a program do they have back in the East and the Midwest and the Central and the Eastern Flyways? What are they doing? Are they shooting them, or what are they doing to them? And besides that, what would you do with one once you shot it?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, maybe you could have barbecues at rodeos in Wasco County.
we'll make a recommendation to Representative Huffman on that.
No, seriously, I'm not aware of anybody other than maybe an eagle or something like that that really likes to eat cormorants. What they've tied it and linked it to back in the Midwest is depredation on private aquaculture, and the birds are destroyed, and I'm not aware of what they actually do with them. I do know that South Carolina is in the process right now of implementing more of a recreational hunting season associated with the depredation permit, and actually have found that it's quite popular, and they have a lot of people applying for those permits to assist the state in dealing with cormorants in sensitive areas. So again, because of the depredation order, it opens up a lot of different alternatives for the states on how they can design things in the most economical way to deal with the problem within their state. And it just varies state by state. In some cases, the state's taking action. In other places, it might be the private aquaculture facilities themselves that are taking action. And you know, we would look, if once we can get to that point here, we would look at all those options ourselves.
Representative Krieger.
Kurt, do you recall what year it was this body put funds in your budget for an avian position?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, that would have been in the 2009 session.
So we're something like 4 years out, five.
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, that, yeah, that's correct.
I can remember meeting with Mr. Hannon. First of all, we had a meeting prior to him coming down, and the feds told us about it would take 2 years, which would be from now 2 years back. So 2 years ago, we were supposed to have been there, and now they're we met with Mr. Hannon last spring with the Cormorant group up here, and he said it would be another 2 years. So that gets it out from the beginning. You'd be out towards 6 years before you get to management. Are you confident that they've given you the criteria that you have to meet, that they are in fact going to work with you to get to management?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, we are confident, and Ron can speak to that more directly, but we've had a number of conversations with the service at the regional executive level, and their commitment to us was, as Ron described, that they would be very clear in what it was we needed to deliver, as opposed to the bring us another rock approach, that they're going to be very clear to us in terms of what we need to deliver in our application, and that we are now on that track. Now, I, of course, can't absolutely speak for them, and, you know, there are certainly things may change, but at least our understanding right now with them is that we're on the right track.
Very good.
Please.
This fall is probably going to take a year or two to get through. Does the department have the commitment not only mentally with as policy to see it through, but do you have the revenue within the department to do whatever needs to be done to get to that management point?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, we certainly, with, as Ron mentioned, with the additional appropriation of general fund in this last session, which we've used to match up with federal Pittman-Robertson dollars to do some additional work, we think we have the good, you know, the resources in place. We have the basically the permanent avian coordinator position and those additional resources. So the short answer is yes, we think we're on track revenue-wise.
I think, Mr. Chair, that has got to be a priority for the department. I think that's what basic community of fishers that involve salmon and steelhead expect of the department. It would be probably your number one charge other than your LC Research Center. A further question, Mr. Chair.
Please.
You and I had a conversation yesterday just briefly in my office, and I was somewhat concerned, and it also shows up in the paper of where you are in your cormorant plan with them, about the feds possibly wanting to move cormorants terns. And my understanding is that's not a physical capturing and moving, but maybe destroying habitat there, which will cause them to disperse to some other location. I'll give you an opportunity to tell me what you told them, but I would encourage you not to allow that. We've got enough predation everywhere else in Oregon, and to increase that predation in other areas, I think you're going to be disproportionately affecting wild stock. And as you pull back from hatchery stocks, there's not as many streams. You're going to cause crowding of those fish in other streams and a higher rate of predation, so we don't want to have that. But could you address
sure.
how vehemently you are going to oppose their plan?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, thanks. So if I could just go a little bit of background. So what Representative Krieger is referring to is on the Columbia, there's the biological opinion, and part of the biological opinion is addressing the effects of avian predation, and in particular right now it's focused on cormorants. One of the alternatives, of course, in the federal process and developing an EA or an EIS, there's a range of alternatives for dealing with this abundance of cormorants in the lower Columbia. One of the alternatives is what I would term a more passive approach, and that is you modify the habitat in such a way that it causes the problem cormorants to disperse to other areas. And we've been very clear that that is not an approach that we're interested in because of the impacts. We're facing already have our own issues in Oregon's estuaries. We don't need to compound that with additional birds moving to those estuaries from Columbia. So that's what I would call, and it's my language, not theirs, that's kind of the passive approach to solving the lower Columbia problem. We certainly think that in our minds, the best approach is that you lethally remove a segment of the population to address the concern, as opposed to just forcing them to become a problem somewhere else.
Yes.
So it's much like, if I might, it's much like when we're dealing with other animal damage situations in agricultural lands, we don't like just moving the problem animals somewhere else so they become the problem in the next county.
Right.
So our approach has been more direct. And nonetheless, it is still one of their alternatives, and we're speaking in opposition to that.
Thank you very much, Representative Krieger.
Last comment. It seems strange that they can kill barred owls to protect spotted owls, but they can't kill cormorants to protect a dangerous salmon.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've got the priorities in the right place.
Representative Krieger, thank you very much for that entire line of questioning. It was very important. Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
I just have a question. question because I'm not really familiar with the cormorants. Anecdotally, we will see large populations of them on certain segments of the rivers or around the lake in the Klamath Basin. And I was just wondering how they move, because, and how you count them, because there are certain times of the spring and summer season that one week you will see 1,000 of them in a set of trees, and then they're gone for all of the rest of the season. And so I'm trying to figure out how you count them and how they move. And are the do these cormorants then go to the ocean? Because they don't spend the winter, I don't think, in Klamath. It's way too cold. I mean, they just freeze to death. But maybe you could sort of help us understand how they move. And
sure. Chair Witt, Representative Witt said, I'll take the high-level answer, and then I'll let Ron fill out any details if he would like. But you heard earlier Mr. Cloutier referenced the breeding pairs as our index of population. And what you mentioned, Representative Whitsett, is exactly why we're using breeding pairs. When they're paired up and breeding, they're in colonies, and they're relatively easy to keep, you know, relatively easy to keep track of. They're in these localized areas, and we can account for them. When you're talking about the population at large, very difficult to enumerate because of their dispersed nature and their migratory patterns. And Ron, if you want to add anything to that, feel free.
Certainly. Chair Witt, Representative Whitsett, what you really are talking about is the non-breeding birds, and that has been a struggle for all of us in the bird world to figure out how to accurately count those birds, because they do move around a lot. They don't necessarily, timing-wise, end up in the same places at the same time, and it can be very difficult to count them. What the studies have shown so far is that for every breeding pair, there's another 1 to 3 non-breeders out there, so there's a range of values. And, you know, as we've reported to you and as Representative Krieger has accurately pointed out, that when you just use the breeding pairs, that is a minimum number of birds that are out there on the landscape, and that you have to account for all those others. So, as Kurt said, what we do focus on is the breeding colonies. Those are done with aerial photography, and then we actually, here in Oregon, we've trained one of our staff. Lindsay used to be our predation coordinator over on the coast. She is now trained in the federal method to count those colonies and count the birds on the colonies from the photographs, and we're setting up this pretty rigorous population estimation for the whole Pacific Flyway, and then we'll extrapolate numbers with the non-breeders. You know, it's one of those we could pour a lot of money into to studying how many non-breeders are out there. We'd rather have pour money into action than doing a whole awful lot of more studies and get past, as I said earlier, bring us another rock on trying to figure out what's going on when we think we have a basic understanding of what's going on and we want solutions.
So do they move because they've completely predated an area? When you have these hundreds or thousands of birds at a time, and then you go by the next week and they're all gone, have they taken all the food out of those stretches of the river then, or what causes them to move on in mass like that?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsett, there's probably a lot of factors that come into play. If they are local non-breeders, that depending on the time of the year, they probably are just moving around, like a herd of elk will move around, or a herd of antelope. It won't stay in one spot all the time. It's constantly moving. If they are, in fact, migratory birds that are heading either to the wintering area, or they're heading back to their spring-summer areas, then a lot of times what you'll see is this stop in a spot, stay there for a little bit, and then move to another spot with just a constant heading in the overall direction of where they want to go. So we do know that that occurs both in the interior portion of Oregon and also on the coastal portions, because we do have birds that not only winter in Oregon, but we have a lot of birds that winter down in the California area, and they will move back this way as they move back to their breeding grounds and their summering areas.
I just have one more follow-up.
That's fine.
And I don't know anything about birds, but would it be possible to band some of these to see what you're looking at, if they're migratory ones or if they are these sort of herds of juveniles or whatever, like have big colored bands, because you can see them pretty close. I mean, when they're in these trees, they just sit there, so you can get really close. Could you have, like, big blue bands or big pink bands or something to sort of track what you're looking at? I'm talking about interior birds. Obviously, that probably doesn't work on the coast, but...
Chair Witt, Representative Witt, we actually are banding birds, or the service and the Corps are banding birds on the Columbia, and we are part of the money that we got this last session from the legislature we're using to try and verify movement associated with those bands. I'm not aware that we have actually undertaken much on that relative to the interior portion of Oregon. So we certainly, that is something that could be done. Right now it's being done as part of the larger effort associated with the Columbia.
Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I truly appreciate your background information. Is there anyone else who would like to testify today on House Bill 4046 in the audience? Not seeing anyone. Committee members, before I close the public hearing on this bill, I think the information that we heard suggests, one, that there may be a higher level of respect for the studies that have been done by this state and others. There's also, I think... perhaps movement towards wanting to get us to a place that we need to be in this state from the federal government. And I also heard, in response to Representative Krieger's questioning, the funding situation that the department has overall may have improved. All of these things, I think, a more positive outlook on this situation than maybe when we visited this topic in the 2013 session. With that said, the consideration that I as chair have is, do we move forward with the expenditure of taxpayer funds on a study that it looks like we're in a better place than we were? And so I am going to ask the committee members that if any of you feel that we should be moving forward with this bill, to please let co-chairs Frederick and or Vice Chairs Frederick and Esquivel.
See, you made the mistake too.
I know. Well, I'm just getting used to it.
Feel promotion.
If you would please let them know your feelings. I want to visit with both of them tomorrow afternoon to make some decisions on this bill. With that, I'm Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes, one thing. When I was growing up in Medford, we used to have, I believe, a bounty on some of these predators. I think we had a $7.50 per scalp on coyote, paid by the county, had 50 cents per nose on porcupines, and you had I believe in Eastern Oregon, 5 cents for a set of jackrabbit ears. I think that's what it was, paid by the county. And that's what kept the population down. We've obviously gone away from that on certain things. And I think that, and I pass a note to the chair here, I would also like to know what we're engaging in with the sage grouse, because that's coming to the forefront. We have a population that may be suspect at this point, but more importantly, what are we doing to enhance that population, not only with habitat, but with predators? And the next thing we need to ask the question is why we have a hunting season on them. So anyway, that's coming to the future.
All right. Thank you very much. Committee members, get with your co-vice chairs. I'd appreciate it. And we are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4046. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4049. And Beth, could you tell us about that bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4049 would modify the existing restrictions on the transfer of vessel, ocean, Dungeness crab permits to allow subsequent transfers. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you very much. I am going to recognize our colleague, Representative Krieger, when he gets to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1, Southern Oregon Coast. This bill came out as a result of a bill we heard last year regarding the theft of crabs and crab pots, and we found there were some lacking things in the law, and also that the commercial fish limited entry permit that dealt with crabs was not in the list of protected permits, because that is a person's entire livelihood. So we added 508926, which is a limited entry permit, to those permits that are not suspended. Instead, they suspend the individual commercial fisherman who committed the violation, because oftentimes the boat is being operated by someone that doesn't own it. Therefore, you're penalizing the entire crew and everybody involved. So that does make that change, and it does allow for both the court and the commission to suspend the other type of licenses to keep these people from violating. The other part of the bill, and those permits are for salmon, shrimp, nearshore fish, gillnet, and the crab, so that it would be consistent across all of the limited entry permits that are issued by the state. The other part of the bill that we dealt with was we found, I think we had 444 original crab permits. We're down about 10, I believe, in 10 years. So we're not having a great big reduction in them. But originally, there was a concern about the capacity of the fleet to catch whatever was available. A couple of years ago, we went into a crab pot limit, where now that each boat has, based on their past catch record, has a certain number of pots they can fish. So the capacity is really much more controlled now than it was. Well, one of the things we found is that if a crab boat, had a permit, let's say on a 90 or 100-foot boat, and that then was moved down, he sold that and it went down to a smaller boat. And the instance I have is one of my people in Brookings wanted to take it down to a new boat. Well, if you put it on the smaller boat that was more than 10 feet smaller, he could never move it back up, and that served no purpose whatsoever. So this just allows a permit that comes off of a boat of, let's say, 90 feet to go back up to any other boat of 90 feet, and it benefits the fishermen sometimes if they want to go out of business and sell and retire.
Fantastic. Thank you. Questions or comments for our colleague? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much, Representative Krieger.
Thank you.
I'd like to call forward now, please, Nick Edwards and Joe Rollator. Mr. Edwards, I understand you've had a bit of a travel getting here this morning. Welcome to our committee.
I got here last night.
Well, Johnny on the spot.
Off to Portland tomorrow.
Well, we appreciate your appearance. Welcome. Gentlemen, it's...
We'll start. Go ahead.
Okay.
Start.
Okay. Answer questions.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Nick Edwards. I'm from Coos Bay, Oregon. I'm here to make public comment on support of House Bill 4049. I'm a commissioner for the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission, and I've been a commercial fisherman for 35 years. My vessel, the fishing vessel Carter John, holds three limited entry permits for Dungeness crab, pink shrimp, and trawl salmon. I wanted to point out to this committee that the Oregon Dungeness crab fishery is the largest single-species fishery in all of Oregon, with average landings of $48.6 million. Using a safe economic multiplier of times two by the Oregon Department of Agriculture, that's $97 million flowing through Oregon's ports and its coastal communities. With that said, the Dungeness crab fishery has its challenges and eventual change. While reviewing Senate Bill 198 during the 2013 legislative session, I discovered a huge inequity in the way of Dungeness crab permits. ORS 580-926 can be revoked in comparison with other state-managed fisheries like Oregon Columbia River gillnet, Oregon pink shrimp, and Oregon salmon trawl. My Dungeness crab vessel permit could be revoked for the action of an individual on that boat, whereas under the current law, the vessel permit and these other fisheries can't be revoked for the actions of that individual on the vessel. The loss of my vessel permit could result in a huge entire loss and shutdown for the whole season. This would be a huge economic loss of income for me, my employees, my port, and the state of Oregon, who were not involved in the original violation. House Bill 4049 addresses this and ensures the protection to the vessel permit and directs accountability to the individual in person. The Oregon Dungeness crab fishery has 423 permits. A major percentage of these permit holders do not go to sea. They hire captains to run their vessels during the season. Currently, the owner of a Dungeness crab permit has a large exposure to losing its vessel permit. I believe this is an unforeseen consequence when the law was put into statute. House Bill 4049 puts stability back to the permit holder and places responsibility to the individual. This is a good bill for Oregon. It's a good bill for the fishery. In closing, many vessels compete in one, two, or three fisheries in Oregon. My personal business plan has six employees that depend on an active Oregon Dungeness crab permit. I also hire captains to run my business, both in shrimp and crab. I hope they would never put my business or my permits at risk, so obviously I do not condone violations on my boat in any manner. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to express the importance of passing House Bill 4049. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I live in Walport, Oregon. I've been involved in the past in development of these limited entry fisheries. Each of these four state-managed fisheries, shrimp, crab, gillnet, and ocean salmon, developed from basically when I bought my first commercial fish license in Winchester Bay. You just bought a license for yourself and for your boat, and it was wide open. But as these fisheries develop and we know more about the resources and how we utilize the resource, the fisheries mature. And the crab limited entry fishery is the last one that went limited entry, and somehow in the growth and maturation of these fisheries, we need to change the rules every once in a while. And House Bill 4049 fixes two of the issues with the crab fisheries to bring it in line with the other state-managed fisheries. So I'm here to answer questions, if I can. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Do we have any questions? Gentlemen, I think you did such a superb job that you've got this one nailed.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Speechless.
Yes. As Vice Chair Esquivel says, they have us speechless. Anyone else to testify today on House Bill 4049? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on that bill. Committee members, I have received information that those higher up on the food chain in this building would like us to be moving bills out so that they have some bills for the floor. So I'm going to go back through and move a couple of these bills.
Mr. Chair, yes, just for FY, for our own purposes, do we have fiscals on some of these, or is there any fiscals on?
You do. You, there are no fiscals on any of the bills from today. They're
not at all.
Minimals, but okay. Yeah,
we're not only speechless, we're fiscalists.
Yeah, we're fiscalists.
All right. With that, committee members, I'm going to open a work session on HCR 203. I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you very much. Chair Witt, I move HCR 203 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thanks very much. Representative Frederick moves HCR 203 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Plum.
Aye.
Representative
Krieger. Aye. Representative Reardon. Aye. Representative Thompson. Aye. Representative Unger. Aye. Representative Woodson.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Askabal.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. A motion passes unanimously, and HCR is the HCR is adopted. Thanks very much. I'm going to close the work session on that resolution. Wait a minute. Yes, I need to assign a carrier. Temporarily reopen the work session and assign Rep. Huffman. Close the work session. Okay. Next, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4045. That is the well constructors bill.
Am I doing this again?
Recognize once again, please, Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I move House Bill 4045 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Frederick moves House Bill 4045 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, hearing none, the motion passes and it is adopted. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session.
Carrier.
Oh, Carrier. Going too fast here. Thank you, Beth. Who would like to carry this bill? Is there anyone? Representative and Vice Chair Frederick, as our newest member, have you carried a bill on behalf
of the committee? No, I will do that. That's fine.
Thank you very much.
You.
With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 4045. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4049.
Here we go again.
I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Frederick.
Chair Witt, I move House Bill 4049 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Frederick moves House Bill 4049 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I'm not seeing any. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Plum.
Aye.
Representative
Krieger. Aye.
Representative
Reardon. Aye. Representative Thompson. Aye. Representative Unger. Aye. Representative Woodson. Aye. Vice Chair Askabal.
Aye.
Vice Chair Friedrich.
Aye.
Chair
Witt. Votes aye. The motion passes. And I would like to have Representative Krieger, would you be willing to carry this bill?
Aye.
Very good. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 4049. Committee members, do you have anything for the good of the order? Beth, would you tell us about coming events so that folks know what bills we have in line and when we're going to be hearing them?
Sure. So members, this Thursday, February 6th, we're going to begin with an informational session on water rights. There are four speakers that have been invited to come, five apparently, I guess, speakers. Also, there'll be a public hearing on House Bills 4044 and 4064, they're identical bills. And then on February 11th, public hearings on House Bill 4139 on bees and House Bill 4075, which is a bill related to hunting. And that is the extent of the bills in committee.
Very good. And with that, if there's nothing else, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much. We stand adjourned. Thank you very much.